BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're about to listen to Havana Helmet Club. New episodes will be released weekly, wherever you get your podcasts. But if you're in the UK, you can listen to the latest episodes a week early on BBC Sounds. Just to let you know, this episode contains strong language and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Jim, I'm here.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good, I'm here.
Okay, great. So can you tell me, when did you first go down to Cuba?
June of 1960.
Jim Tracy was a young Marine security guard stationed at the U.S. Embassy in Havana, Cuba.
I loved the people.
It was easy to make friends with the Cubans.
The Havana Jim remembers was this in-between time where the city was still a playground for visiting Americans. Much of Cuba ran on American capital. A lot of it was mob money. But Fidel Castro had just swept to power and everything was changing.
We could tell that they didn't want us there. They were threatening to send us all home.
That summer, Castro began seizing U.S. assets in Cuba. It looked like he was rejecting the American way and embracing its enemy, Mother Russia.
Things would happen during the night. We had a code clerk get shot out in town by an off-duty Cuban Army officer. The code clerk was paying his bar bill in American money, which you could do, and the Cuban accused him of passing counterfeit bills, and they got into an argument and shoving mass, and the Cuban took out a .45 and shot him in the stomach. And finally, after that guy was shot and a couple other little incidents, President Eisenhower says, that's enough, we're leaving. And so the Cubans came back and said, okay, we'll give you 48 hours to get out.
Jim and two other Marines took down the American flag from outside the embassy building, fed classified documents into a huge burner.
Pull a switch and whoosh!
Then they hitched a ride out of Havana on a coal ferry. They made a promise to each other to return and raise the flag again once the two countries had worked things out.
Because we figured it'd only be a couple years, you know.
But instead it grew into a rift that would span almost the rest of Jim's life. America imposed a total block on trade with Cuba, known as the embargo. They became the longest-running sanctions in modern history, and they failed to remove Fidel Castro, who responded by denouncing America as an imperialist king destined to fall.
Then 54 years later, Jim got a phone call. From almost out of the blue, Barack Obama and Raul Castro had come together to end decades of hostility.
You don't know how it feels to pick up your phone and say hello and this is the White House calling.
They were asking him to return to Havana and put that flag back up. So in August 2015, Jim and his old Marine buddies assembled outside the newly reopened U.S. Embassy in Havana.
54 years ago, you gentlemen promised to return to Havana and hoist the flag over the United States Embassy that you lowered on that January day long ago.
Promise made, promise kept, as the Secretary of State said.
It was a heady time. Church bells rang out in Havana. Students celebrated in the streets.
Havana is only 90 miles from Florida. But to get here, we had to travel a great distance.
At the height of this carnival atmosphere, Adam, the CIA agent who would later become known as Patient Zero, landed in Havana. Adam says the celebrations weren't part of his life as an American spy down there.
You're not welcome there. You're not welcome. The harassment was immediate.
Within 3 months of his arrival, Adam raised the alarm that he had been the victim of a strange and devastating attack. If he was right, it would upend everyone's notion of what was going on, that there was finally a moment of hope.
No one wanted to hear anything that would go against that, that everything's rosy and good.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Havana Helmet Club. I'm Sam Bungie.
I'm Jennifer Ford, and this is Episode 2, Old Habits. Peacemakers came in many guises. Hollywood actors, a group of Minnesota farmers. In the summer of 2002, when I was in Havana, I watched former WWE wrestler turned state governor Jesse Ventura call for change in the lobby of the Hotel Nacional. But seeking a better future between the US and Cuba has been like trying to resolve a family blood feud. You might tend to old wounds, begin to build trust. Then some vengeful aunt or uncle will come along and take the whole thing out at the knees. As one US ambassador put it, Cuba seemed to have the same effect on American administrations as the full moon has on werewolves.
Everything's out of scale when it came to Cuba.
This is former US Senator Patrick Leahy.
A few politicians could stand and say, we're standing up to those evil communists in Cuba. Oh, come on.
Leahy retired a couple of years ago as one of the longest-serving American senators. A Democrat from Vermont, he took on humanitarian causes from landmines to the arms trade, and since his college days had been curious about America's stance towards Cuba.
I was wondering why this enormous obsession with a small country off our coast. And as I listened to the rhetoric, more and more it sounded like it was just that, rhetoric. I wanted to go down and look at it myself.
People were struggling.
That's Marcelle Leahy, Senator Leahy's wife, who traveled with him on his first trip to Cuba back in the late 90s.
There were shortages in all sorts of things.
Then we got a call. Could we join President Castro for dinner at 10? I think it was 10.
Yes, it was.
And so we sat down at the table, and Castro launches into what I could see was going to be an hour-long monologue. So I waited about 4 or 5 minutes. I said, oh, no, wait a minute. I disagree with that. The whole atmosphere changed. Do we approve of their former government, especially under Fidel Castro? Well, I sat there at the table with them and told them where I disagree. I said, that's what we should be doing.
Maybe you can't pinpoint exactly where the conversation began that would lead to those celebrations in the street, the reopened embassy, the re-hoisted flag, that bold new future that Adam risked upending. But you could make a case that it started with Senator Leahy and the man who, for 30 years, worked alongside him.
He wanted a different relationship with the Cubans.
That's Tim Risa, a foreign policy advisor and the senator's right-hand man on Cuba.
One that was based on trust, on openness, on consistency, on respect, all the things that had been lacking in the way in which our government had been dealing with the Cubans and then with us.
In 2014, Risa headed over to the White House to make a pitch.
I said, you know, I think Obama should go to Cuba. Nixon went to China. Reagan worked things out with Gorbachev. Cuba's right here, and the Cubans would love Obama.
It was bold. A sitting American president hadn't visited Cuba in nearly a century. But there was a problem. The Cubans had thrown an American contractor in jail on charges of espionage.
And I knew what the Cubans wanted because the Cubans made clear that they wanted the return of their prisoners, the three remaining prisoners from the Cuban Five, as they were called.
A notorious group of Cuban spies sent to infiltrate anti-Castro elements in America and now locked up in maximum security prisons, serving out life sentences. In Cuba, these spies are folk heroes. But in the US, they were enemies of the state. A straight swap was out of the question.
And, you know, I talked to the White House staff about this, and they said, we're not doing that. We're not doing a prisoner exchange.
Obama had already loosened America's grip on Cuba a little. He'd made it easier to travel and for Cubans in the US to send money home. But the arrest of the American had stopped all conversation.
To link our relations with a whole country to one individual makes no sense. It makes no sense that until we solve that problem, we can't talk about anything else. Where in the world do we do that? We don't.
Risa and Leahy seem to be the kind of guys who take a no as the beginning of a conversation. Not long after that meeting at the White House, they returned to Havana, where the Cubans came to them with a different problem.
There's a woman who wanted to meet with us.
She was the wife of one of the Cuban Five, the spies who were in prison in the US.
She was in love with her husband, been in love with him since she was a teenager. She wanted to have a baby.
She felt very strongly that her biological clock was ticking, and she just spoke from the heart. And she said, please talk with your husband and convince him to help us.
Anytime the Cubans asked for something of the U.S. government, the answer would invariably be nothing. In other words, no response or no. And our view was, why not do it if there was no reason not to?
This was a quixotic task for a U.S. senator and his aide.
You know, it fell on me to figure out how we were going to do this.
Risa took on the role of this Cuban couple's fertility planner.
Obviously not something I had ever contemplated before, but I just felt that if we did this, it would also help the relationship. And so there was a bigger purpose here, but nevertheless, it came down to this more just very simple issue of biology.
What followed involved some very tricky logistics to do with bringing the Cuban woman to Panama, where they could send her husband's frozen sperm. It's a whole other story, but it worked.
And as though somehow the promise of this baby softened the hearts of these Cold War enemies, they began to talk, or at least whisper. Hardliners on both sides could quickly wreck any hint of reconciliation.
They knew that they could rely on me. I used to meet privately with the ambassador of Cuba quite often just to send messages back and forth. Letters not addressed to anybody and not signed by anybody. But this is for Obama and this is for Castro.
Leahy didn't know the contents of those letters, nor did the Cuban ambassador he was exchanging them with.
No, absolutely. I was sharing the darkness with the others.
Ambassador Jose Cabañas was posted to Washington at the time.
People in Washington, D.C. were asking us if we didn't feel that something was about to change. You felt that there was something on the air.
The secrecy held.
But all this positivity would come to nothing without some unpleasant compromises. Which brings us back to those Cuban spies and the jailed American contractor. The U.S. had been clear, no prisoner swap. But Cuba wouldn't agree to anything else without it. Risa had a new idea. To pull it off, he needed the help of a friend, Tim Phillips, who worked in the delicate world of mediation.
Conflicts, division, whether in a nation, a community, or families, can get stuck until somebody comes along and says, we need to think and act differently. But it often takes somebody who has real status. It was just a few months after Pope Francis became Pope, and he became this iconic global figure of change and progress. He's from Latin America, and he's the Pope. You know, it's like supposedly what Stalin said during World War II, how many divisions does the Pope have, right? Well, the Pope has profound moral authority.
With some fancy diplomacy, they got to the Vatican. Pope Francis, who had long advocated to end the U.S. embargo, saw how a prisoner exchange fitted into the bigger picture. He agreed to join the secret team of dealmakers.
Sending letters to Raul and Fidel Castro, to Obama, to others, and he was helping facilitate these conversations.
The press called them the last prisoners of the Cold War. They were freed on December the 17th, 2015. And 3 months later, Air Force One carried President Obama to Havana.
Today, as the President of the United States of America, I offer the Cuban people el saludo de paz.
The reception for Obama was unbelievable. Crowds all on the street cheering. There were thousands of people out there.
Senator Leahy attended an exhibition baseball game, and he was walking in front of the stands when he heard someone call out his name.
And it was the prisoner and his wife. They say, you're the godfather. We call you the godfather of our child. They're showing me pictures.
Obama cruised the streets, jacket slung over his shoulder with Michelle and the kids. He played dominoes on a Cuban TV show and made a big speech.
In a world that remade itself time and again, one constant was the conflict between the United States and Cuba. I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
You know, for me, having 2 years earlier suggested that Obama go to Cuba, and then for him finally to go there, and to be welcomed like the Pope. I think that was just a great illustration of how much we had accomplished.
People will often tell you that Havana Syndrome doesn't make any sense, that it doesn't fit in to the brave new world Obama described, and that no motive existed to attack Americans in a way that might jeopardize Cuba's new relationship with America. But maybe old habits die hard. 6 months after Obama, a fit-looking American in his early 30s arrived at Jose Marti Airport. He had a business card saying he was a US State Department economics officer. But that's not who he really was. This was Adam, fresh from 3 years of CIA training, arriving for his first assignment.
Touching down then, like, in Havana, I guess, like, what were your first impressions? Were you happy to be there? Were you, like, excited?
Yeah, I think nervous, right? Because you spent all this time waiting to get to this point, but ready, you know? I think the switch flipped for me once you land and you go, oh, I'm here to do a job now. You know, and it's not a holiday, it's not, you know, and everything I've worked up to this point now goes into effect.
Adam's bags were stuffed with supplies, and he was sending on separately things he was told he'd need, like a bread maker, spark plugs, and wheels for his car, even toilet paper. Adam was used to turning up in strange places and having to orientate himself, but this was different.
Were you going into the embassy there?
Yeah, that was my job. Yeah.
Officially, he'd be a liaison working out of the US embassy, another hand to deal with the fire hose of new business coming into Havana from the States. Across the city, American musicians were performing. A Hollywood studio was shooting action sequences. Airbnb had pounced on a gap in the market. Several major US airlines were now flying direct to Havana. It was part of Adam's job to manage that. But of course, he had another role as well.
The lines are so messy in terms of what I'm allowed to say, in terms of who I worked for and what I was doing.
Officially, the CIA doesn't have a presence in other countries. Unofficially, it's everywhere. And the State Department embassies provide a great cover, not only for the identities of their agents, but also as a physical space in which to operate when not in the field. Back in 2001, the agency itself estimated that of the personnel working at US embassies around the world, more than a quarter were undercover CIA agents.
As part of the thaw, there was going to be more of everyone at the embassy, diplomats and spies. But since Castro, the building had fallen into neglect. Some parts were literally crumbling to pieces.
The building was almost, in effect, frozen in time.
Patrick Kennedy was the State Department's Undersecretary of Management. He showed up around the world at State Department buildings in need of help. Now that Obama had ordered the embassy reopened, Kennedy's job was to fix it up. But it would have to be done carefully. The refurbished embassy would be a demonstration of America's hope for a friendly future with Cuba. But Kennedy didn't deal in hope.
We don't run risk, the most stringent rules. American workers, American materials, all the way.
Even in friendly territory, the US wouldn't abandon security at its embassy. But Cuba was on a short list of territories that America considers especially hostile. Kennedy needed to hone in on any weak points in the chain, like the occasions where they couldn't unload their containers from the Havana dock straight away.
Let's say it sits in the port overnight and a hostile intelligence service plants electronic devices within the materials. And that means that when they're installed in the building, you're in effect installing someone else's bugs within your own facility. And I can just say that we do certain things to the container to make sure that we are able to know whether or not someone else has been inside before we got to it.
Are you allowed to share what that is?
No, obviously. We're not going to broadcast our methods to others who might be listening to your broadcast.
Kennedy wouldn't tell me if any of their containers had been surreptitiously tampered with.
But even out in the open, there was the potential for sabotage.
There were forces within the Cuban government that were having second thoughts about the speed and depth of rapprochement with the United States.
This is Richard Feinberg, a US government advisor and Cuba expert. He says these elements were part of a powerful old guard in Cuba known as the Historicos. Feinberg had been in Havana for Obama's visit, and witnessed the reaction of the Cuban people firsthand.
I mean, overall, the Cubans that I spoke to were very excited by Obama's visit. First of all, his youth, as compared to Raul Castro, the historicos, who are like in their 80s, and suddenly Obama, who was what, in his 40s, comes by. Plus, most of the senior leadership in the Cuban Communist Party, with some exceptions, are European white. Obama, obviously, Afro-American. So his youth, his vitality, his ethnicity, all of this, the average Cuban found very exciting. And they started to say, hey, how come we don't have leadership like this? Very shocking to the Cuban government. So it frightened them.
A Guardian writer described the two ways of looking at the image of Obama's plane descending on Havana. It was either a chariot of hope for socialist Cuba, or it represented a capitalist leviathan coming to swallow Cuba whole. Maybe the historico saw it the second way.
They see it as a possible tip of the spear of American influence and eventually the return of the Cuban-American community to regain what they had lost on the island. That's their biggest fear. So as soon as Obama's trip is, he's not yet on the airplane, and you could see in Cuban state-owned media, they started to push back against Obama and the United States.
There was a Communist Party Congress, I think the following month, maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, and the speeches were quite negative.
As former Cuba ambassador Jeff De Laurentiis. De Laurentiis was the first ambassador to Cuba since 1960. Obama had singled him out for praise, saying there was no better public servant, and he wanted him to implement the thaw. He was meant to be helping to agree new partnerships with the Cubans on things like criminal investigations and poultry imports. But De Laurentiis was surprised to find himself being frozen out.
There was a bit of a lull, let's say, until the fall. And I'm assuming that was a reaction to the Obama visit.
When you say a lull, do you mean previously?
I mean, they weren't talking. Emails would go unanswered, kind of a deafening silence.
De Laurentiis says that at an event the Cuban leaders hosted for the entire diplomatic community, they spoke very positively about the new relationship. Just as sharp divisions existed in US politics about how to handle Cuba, it seems Castro's authoritarian government didn't speak with one voice.
And a lot of my counterparts looked at me as if to say, you know, what's going on? Are they happy or are they not happy? And my response was, well, it's both.
If the relationship was already uncertain, in November 2016, two events threw everything up in the air. On November the 8th, Donald Trump surprised everyone by beating Hillary Clinton to the White House. He promised to be a president who burnt, not built, bridges, and he spoke of cancelling all his predecessor's deals. That seemed likely to include Cuba, especially since he had won with the help of the anti-Castro vote in Florida. Trump's election brought Cuba back to the negotiating table.
It was a sense that the clock was ticking and we needed to try and get as much done as we could.
But on November 25th came the other big news. Trump tweeted it. Fidel Castro is dead! Castro's dying wish had been for the Cubans to be careful about getting into bed with America, only adding to those mixed messages Ambassador De Laurentiis was receiving.
I think that was Fidel Castro's last public appearance, if I'm not mistaken, where he made a speech very critical of President Obama, foreign minister, also along the lines of essentially, let's remember they're the enemy, I mean, all of this.
Would his death mark the end of an era? Or would it remind Cubans of everything they had fought for and what they had to lose?
The whole event was fascinating.
Adam joined the thousands of mourners at a memorial rally for Fidel Castro on November 29th in Havana.
I wanted to see it and experience it and be around the Cuban people to see what their thoughts were, what their reactions were.
It was stifling out, and Adam says he was packed in tight in the crowd, getting hot and thirsty, when he noticed he was being tracked.
What you want to be worried about is when your phone gets really, really hot for no reason. Because what that usually means is that your phone is being tasked by an external source. So it felt like my phone was going to catch fire in my pocket. That me and the people I was with from the US Embassy, none of our phones worked, but everyone's phones around ours worked. So they had isolated our phones, stopped them from communicating, out, obviously of fear that we were going to be doing something or whatever. I have a video of it, it's brilliant, of security service working their way through this crowd of like a million people on the radios until they found me.
He showed me the video he shot on his phone that day and asked me to pick out his surveillance. It looked like a festival with people sitting cross-legged on the ground. I pointed to one guy who looked like he couldn't decide whether he wanted to stand up or sit down.
He's like on the radio, and then he's like, oh, fuck, a camera. And then he bends down and hides behind everyone because he doesn't want to be on camera.
Adam says some of the surveillance guys then pulled out their own cameras and started taping him.
Jesus, so intense. There's nothing like covert about any of
this. Oh, no. That's not subtle.
It seemed noteworthy to me that this smartphone skirmish was going on as Cuba was burying the leader that Adam's agency had tried for decades to assassinate. Adam thought of it all as part of a grand caper.
But your whole presence there is...
in Cuba.
You're a CIA agent in Cuba. It's a provocation, right? Like the whole just being...
But you have to understand, there is a spy game that happens all over the world. The game is ongoing, right? You're not going to win anything by being like, well, we respect your country's sovereignty. And so if you're the only one not putting your intelligence officers in other countries, then you're the only stupid one on the block.
For the next month, Adam claims he was under constant surveillance. He says his apartment was broken into, his clothes were soiled, he was run off the road. And then, on the evening of December 29th, he was relaxing at home when that overpowering sound filled his room and the story of Havana Syndrome began. After several encounters with this sound and pressure in his bedroom, he picked up worrying symptoms, dizziness, tiredness, nosebleeds. He also developed a kind of brain fog, like he couldn't think straight. Adam sent several reports to CIA headquarters. The reports themselves became a hardship.
You get to the end of the document that you're doing, you're like, I don't fucking know what I'm supposed to be writing this about. Or you get halfway through it and you're like, this thing took a left turn an hour and a half ago and I don't know where we're at now.
After all that, Adam would click send and then nothing.
DC wasn't listening.
If this was what he thought it was, they weren't just harassing Americans. They were targeting them. They were trying to take CIA agents off the field.
But maybe the worst thing was that no one on Adam's side seemed to be doing anything about it. De Laurentiis told us that he had already informed Washington about the increased harassment in Cuba, but news of the health effects hadn't reached the medical office.
Hi, I'm Charles Rosenfarb, former medical director at the Department of State, U.S. government.
Rosenfarb's job was to manage the health of State Department employees stationed all around the world. Viral outbreaks, workplace injuries.
There's an occasional, you know, bizarre thing that happens. In the Havana stuff, they actually heard about an unusual situation when I was having a kind of a social get-together with my counterpart at the CIA.
Rosenfarb's talking about the CIA's director of medical services.
We spoke regularly, we got together regularly, I mean, on a personal and professional basis. So it was kind of one of our regular dinner meetings.
At dinner in early February, Rosenfarb heard for the first time about something happening in Havana.
And he brought up an incident where a patient there who had some unusual symptoms and some hearing loss. And he was going, we're not sure what's going on. I mean, it's in the nature of who works for the agency not to be too open about stuff. They sometimes don't share information as much as we share with them.
However, the CIA doctor told it, the story out of Havana didn't sit up for Rosenfarb.
I was running a medical program, taking care of 75,000 people, so a lot of other stuff was going on. At the time, it didn't seem like a generalized risk, something that would potentially affect other people. It was just a patient who had a problem. One patient who had an issue.
In Washington, it was a blip on the radar. But what Rosenfarb hadn't been told at that dinner was that it wasn't just one patient. From Adam's perspective in Havana, things were spiraling and victims were piling up. There was the embassy nurse, the security officer, the friend who Adam crashed with after the sound drove him out of his own apartment, and now two others. Another CIA agent shared his experience with Adam in late January, after returning home to seek private medical care for his strange symptoms. And in early February, the wife of an agent reported being assailed by noise in her home in the Flores district of Havana. She went out into the street and claimed she spotted a black van speeding away from the scene. Adam says the van was later tracked down to a known Cuban intelligence safe house. Adam became a sort of unofficial liaison officer for all of them. His reports to the CIA featured increasingly dire warnings about what was happening in Havana. And as far as he could tell, they weren't triggering a response. He began to read into the silence. He came to the view that no one wanted to know about his problems in Cuba, because they threatened a political reality that was good for everyone. Whatever skirmishes might be going on the ground, the priority at the top was still to protect the Thaw, at the very least until Trump got his feet under the Resolute desk.
A lot of people were trying to defend Obama's Cuba policy. That policy was good for work for us, more flexibility, more opportunities, and people didn't want to hear it.
Adam believed he was up against powerful forces, already involved in a conspiracy of silence. On Valentine's Day weekend, his own symptoms finally got the better of him.
I felt real bad, real rough, and I was like, I just need to sleep, and I need to be in a place where I can eat and just try and catch up a bit. I was flying back home to my parents' house, and I left with this bag.
It's a little backpack.
This little satchel.
Yeah.
With like underwear, a couple t-shirts, and like toothbrush and shit. I never went back.
Adam thought he was just leaving Cuba for the weekend, but he was beginning a new life in the realm of the unwell. Back in Havana, his apartment, his car, his embassy desk all sat empty, and he says people began to ask questions.
What people in the embassy did start seeing was that they were sending people to pack out my house. You know, all my stuff had just arrived. I never came back. They were packing out my belongings and was being shipped back out. And so I came onto the island and then I just disappeared and was gone. And then it happened to someone else. And then someone else. And then someone else.
This episode is dedicated to Jim Tracy, that Marine security guard who died in February of this year.
On the next episode of Havana Helmet Club.
The call that I got was, Dr. Hoffer, this is the State Department, we have a problem.
It was an acute event I evaluated, and I go, I think this is real, but I don't know what it is.
Something passed between me and the light source. And it wasn't periodic, like some fan motor that was rotating. It was back and forth. I have no idea what it was, but one explanation could be there was a person back there.
And it's hard to say in Cuba who was behind anything.
Frankly, I didn't know who was following me.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Havana Helmet Club. Listen to the latest episodes first on BBC Sounds.
If you want to be notified when the latest episode drops, make sure you're subscribed to Havana Helmet Club on BBC Sounds and have push notifications turned on.
Havana Helmet Club is written and presented by Sam Bunkey and Jennifer Ford and edited by Guy Crossman.
Our story editor is Mike Olive and our producer is Larry Ryan. Original music by Tom Pintons. Sound design by Merrin Royards. Additional sound design and mix by Peregrine Andrews.
Commissioning editor for the BBC is Dylan Haskins. Assistant commissioning editors are Sarah Green and Natasha Johansson. Havana Helmet Club is a Yarn production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
In today's digital world, it's easier than ever to invade someone's life and far harder to escape.
Anyone determined enough to do harm can find a way to do harm.
I'm Carol Cadwallader, an investigative journalist. In this podcast, I follow the story of Hannah, whose life was turned upside down by an anonymous stalker.
I no longer know who I can trust.
What began as one woman's nightmare became a chilling investigation into deception, control, and the faceless power of the internet. Stalked. Listen on BBC Sounds.